Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Will Blythe, and Will is, of course, the Chapel Hill native and one of the expatriates from Chapel Hill that we're most proud of. He's a successful editor and author. Will, your fame increased in Chapel Hill, I guess, is it now 3 years ago? 3 years ago?
Yes, almost 3 years, exactly.
That your book with the longest title in the world, To Hate Like This Is to Be Happy Forever, a thoroughly obsessive, intermittently uplifting, and occasionally unbiased account of the Duke-North Carolina basketball rivalry.
Yes.
And people here, 3 years later, are still talking about your book. It's for different reasons. You just hit people from so many different angles in your description of what underlies a lot of what makes Chapel Hill tick, and that is hating Duke.
Yes.
That you got it from so many different angles that people from every different perspective I run into who talk about your book. And still, congratulations. You hit a home run with it.
Well, thank you very much, DG. So, you're in there, too, you know.
Believe me, this is what's so fun for me, is that people come up to me and they say, have you read Will Blythe's book? And I say, yeah, I have. Have you read it? Oh, yeah, it's great, isn't it? And so I just kind of write down in my little notebook, can't trust this guy all the way. He doesn't tell
yeah,
the full truth.
Well, he's always taking notes.
He didn't read every page. Otherwise, he would have known that I had one or two pages in your book. And I mean, when I am gone, that's going to be in the little collection of the box that I give to my grandchildren about places that I made my mark on this world. I got in Will Blythe's book.
Well, that's good to hear.
Well, basketball is always a hot topic, and it never more so than in the middle of the NCAA finals. And we don't have Duke and Carolina playing each other right now, but we got both of them playing this week.
Right.
So here's what I want. First of all, you tell us what you want to, but my first question is, a couple of weeks ago, Duke and Carolina did play again, and it was in Chapel Hill, and it was the source of a lot of passion in Chapel Hill. It was almost like a national championship game, and I wonder if you were able to follow that game.
Oh, yeah, no, I wouldn't have missed that. I watched that game from up here in New York, and I think there's a lot of passion now because Duke seems to be improving just a little bit after having made that midseason switch and put Shire at point guard and Elliot Williams off the bench, where he'd been in the deep freeze actually all season, you know, this amazing talent. And it seems like Duke has had at least a mini resurgence. And I think that whenever the other team in that rivalry begins to get decent again, it stokes the fires.
Well, in your book, you talk about some of the rituals that you and other, and your friends, and the reactions of your friends to your rituals. I'm going to be disappointed if you say, well, I watched that game by myself and nobody knows what I did, and I really didn't do anything other than watch it.
The only problem is that's true. In some games, you actually sort of want to watch by yourself,
yeah,
so that you can give full vent to your darker emotions. And I did indeed watch that game by myself. But as usual, during the game and after the game, I had lots of telephone consultations with, among other people, among other Carolina fans, my mother. So there were a lot of rituals that stayed the same.
Well, how did Gloria, can you give us a insight into the conversation between you and your mom, our great friend Gloria Blythe?
Right. They tend to run the same way. I mean, she's much more of an alarmist than I am. And so that when she's not really comfortable, as is the case, I think, with many Carolina fans, unless UNC has about a 20 to 25 point
with 30 seconds left.
Yeah, and I'd say that's pushing it, actually. I think really she's at her most comfortable when it's about a 40-point lead with about 10 seconds left. But so that game, I think, was at times a little bit anxiety-provoking. But, you know, I think somehow, having become inadvertently one of the world's foremost authorities on Duke hating over the last 3 years, what's amazing to me is how many, I didn't realize the degree to which other people out there have rituals and have such a similar relationship to this, you know, to this particular rivalry. Because going around the state of North Carolina doing readings from the book, people would come up to me and tell me things that were just more extraordinary than what we ever did in our household. You know, things like taping their mother to the floor and
Wait a minute. Taping their mother. You got to give us the full story.
Yeah,
not like
well,
you can't.
Okay. It was one family came up to me, and after I had confessed to my own particular insanity, I guess they felt like, you know, now we can all tell our tales. And one family came up to me and said, you know, during our during one particular run of Good Fortune Fair Carolina, actually what had happened was they were watching a game at home, and Carolina had been down in that particular game and then come back. And at the very moment that they'd started to come back, their mother had been in a particular place on the living room floor. And as I do know this sort of thing happens, they said to her, stay right there. Don't move. You know, because I guess karmically they thought that her position was related to the success of the team. And Carolina did so well that they insisted that she stay in that same place for the rest of the season or until Carolina lost again.
Oh, my golly. Well,
And what's beautiful about this story is actually she was willing to do that for the team.
Well, this is so, and you explore this in your book, the stories like this are, as you point out, are not uncommon.
Right.
And the thing that we've shared with each other most is that people with particular items of clothing or particular jackets or ties or sweaters or something get to be the lucky item of clothing that people do this. And it seems do you guys really believe that this makes a difference? And do they really believe it makes a difference? You're both an observer and a participant. I don't know whether we can count on you to give an accurate answer.
Yeah, I know. I sometimes look at myself with horror, you know, thinking, with my sort of scientific rationalist mind, thinking, what in the world am I doing? And why would I think that sitting this particular way or making these, these gestures at the TV will have any effect? On the other hand, I mean, at Duke University, as a matter of fact, you may remember they once did a study, not too many years back, on the efficacy of prayer. And as a good Presbyterian, DG, you will be happy to know that that study, conducted scientifically, suggested that total strangers prayed for, that were in a hospital, actually, as I recall, tended to do better than patients who had not been prayed for. Now, if that's the case, and if that is confirmed at Duke University, then is it not possible that when we watch a game and we start praying really hard for somebody to miss a free throw, that we might actually affect the course of that free throw?
Well, that is a great question, and
it's one of the greater philosophical questions that still exist, I think, to be solved.
It's interesting to me that you've confessed that you have some, that your Presbyterian heritage with appreciation and some skepticism.
Yes.
And that there are those who have lost their the faith of their youth, of their growing up.
Right.
But they do believe in these, they do believe that they can influence basketball games by sitting in certain positions and crossing their legs in different ways, taping their moms to the floor.
That's right. I mean, well, that is really, one of the things I wanted to write about in the book was that that feeling of basketball as a religion. I mean, I know that in North Carolina people talk about it in this kind of very cursory way, that, you know, ACC basketball is a religion, but I really wanted to look at that quite sincerely and see the extent to which, following a basketball game and going through the highs and the lows of emotion approximated religious experience, and also related to religious experience in North Carolina, and was an outlet, I think, for lots of good Christian people to vent their dark sides.
Well, some of the most wonderful passages in your book relate to the extraordinary relationship that you had with your dad, who was such a wonderful physician and writer here in Chapel Hill, and one of these great intellectuals who was also, you know, a sort of passionate basketball yeah. fan.
Yeah.
And your dad was an intellectual, but at the same time he would let loose, wouldn't he? I mean, he would. I mean, and I saw him in church. I mean, he was very staid. He was Presbyterian in church.
Yes.
But
he was certainly he was all those things you say very kindly, and I think that he primarily cut loose in basketball when he was watching Duke. With other teams, I don't think he felt the same degree of animosity. And in fact, there was a time when he went to, I think it was Carmichael, or it may have been the early days of the Dean Dome, with my brother John, and he got, I think, upset with how loud the Carolina fans were cheering against the other team, and he said at that point, he stood up and said, bring in the Christians, and throw them to the lions, basically. So then I think he had a sense that there ought to be some decorum, which is really very much like what Dean Smith, I think, argued all these years. I mean, Dean didn't like it when Carolina fans would wave their hands as the other team shot free throws.
Yeah, that's a different difference in generations, and I'm on the border of those generations. Growing up in Davidson, at Davidson College, particularly, right. There was this blend of hot competitiveness, but at the same time, the hero of my growing up years was Whit Cobb from Durham, who was loose on had stolen the ball and was loose for a layup, going in for a layup at the other end, and he heard the guy that he'd stolen the ball from fall down, and he stopped and picked him up. You know,
is that right?
Yeah, you know, that was the story. And it was he was still a great basketball player, but when it came to being a gentleman, you know, you put all those sides. Now, that was 60-some years ago now that alleged story took place. But there is this this difference.
I just can't imagine John Shire doing that.
I don't know. I know you. And you would be, golly, you couldn't go back to school if you did something like that.
No, I mean, now I could see somebody picking someone up like that so that they could then dunk over them. But Davidson, Davidson is, speaking of Presbyterianism again, I mean, there's, you know, I think you mentioned the whole notion of the warlike Presbyterian, which I always was fascinated by.
Well, I tell you what, let's take a break. We'll come back and we'll talk about religion, basketball. We're visiting with Will Blythe, the author of To Hate Like This Is to Be Happy Forever, his exploration of a personal exploration of his feelings and those of others in connection with the Duke-Carolina rivalry. And he and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Will Blythe. Will is the Chapel Hill native and also now even more known than from his exploits when he was growing up in Chapel Hill. He's known as the author of the seminal work on the Duke-Carolina basketball rivalry, To Hate Like This Is to Be Happy Forever, subtitled A Thoroughly Obsessive, Intermittently Uplifting, and Occasionally Unbiased Account of the Duke North Carolina basketball rivalry. Your description of it and our conversation earlier leads me to say, let's keep talking about basketball as a religion.
Right.
And the aspects of it are superstition. And you said that as you traveled around after you wrote the book, you collected a catalog of stories of the various superstitions of things that people did during the game, and I got so interested in the first item that you mentioned about taping the mama to the floor.
Yes.
That I didn't push you to tell us a couple of other stories. Can you do that for us?
Well, I had one fellow, actually, I gave a reading over at Duke, and one fellow came up to me, and he had actually done this, it's a painting, actually, one of those sort of Tree of Life paintings. But he had substituted Duke and Carolina and Roy and Coach K and so on for all the normal religious figures. But actually, one of the guys that I was sort of most compelled by is a fellow who lives just outside of Chapel Hill who used to be an Episcopal minister and had the bright idea one day of basically representing the Duke-Carolina rivalry sort of in the style of Lord of the Rings, and he decided that this had to be done graphically. So he spent his days and evenings making this poster, actually, which is incredibly complicated, and it became his sort of guiding passion for a while. I think you can actually go down and buy it at Sutton's, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, is that right? Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it was just one of these things where you realize there's all this artistic energy being expended on representing the rivalry. And again, I don't think I ever would have known this had I not written a book and had people come up to me, you know, like we were fellow members of Alcoholics Anonymous or something, saying, you know what I did? And that's one story that I got to witness at close range.
We've talked about it as basketball, and particularly this rivalry between Carolina and Duke, as either religion or a substitute for religion, for doing the kinds of things that religion might have done for humans in the past. That is, building a collective civic identity and a tribal spirit that brings people together in a common culture and a common emotion.
Right.
Now, I want to suggest something else. I don't know. I don't know where you go with this, but I mean, I've been watching some of the films of the early days of the Nazi movement in Germany,
right,
as this compelling leader brought his followers and Germans to shout together, scream together, to get mad at other people together in a frenzy, that was, looking at it backwards, it's just uncivilized in some respects and terrible in the sense that it brought out horrible results in terms of what happened to the hatred of a different group of people that resulted in the Holocaust. And so as I watch these passionate fans at the Smith Center hollering for blood against Duke, I keep thinking, what are we doing? Are we feeding this sort of...
Well, that's a good question. That's one of the questions that I had. And I actually went at one point to this famous Buddhist scholar named Robert Thurman, who coincidentally happens to be the father of Uma Thurman. And
my golly,
I went to him I wanted to know, first of all, whether I was going to be whether I was going to be reincarnated as some kind of insect because I hated Duke so much. And I wondered how many years I would have to spend, you know, before I could get off the karmic wheel. But one of the things we did start talking about was whether sports rivalries were training fans to be sort of bloodthirsty and militaristic, or whether in fact they were a good outlet for passionate but dark emotions that otherwise might find expression in war, for instance. And he himself was sort of undecided about it. He felt like, we talked about the Olympics, he felt like the Olympics in a way had been bastardized, that they were supposed to be the latter, you know, a sort of outlet for competitiveness without vile sort of evil emotion spilling into them. So he was saying that with a sports rivalry, it could go either way in his estimation. And it does seem sometimes, I mean, it must be a little bit like what it is when a country has some sort of rally and there's always a group that's kind of the other, and then you have the in group. And that's not unlike the dynamics of a sports rivalry, even Duke Carolina.
Well, it's real interesting. My granddaughter is about 6.5 years old, and we took her to the baseball game, Carolina baseball game the other day. They were playing Clemson, and so the orange uniforms were very noticeable.
Yeah.
And this is my granddaughter's favorite color. Prior to this had been orange, and so it was very hard for her to transfer her loyalty from her favorite color to the blue of the Tar
right.
Heels, which she was a big Tar Heel fan.
Yes.
But the other, so this was a week ago, or a week and a half ago. And so then yesterday, I got a telephone call, and there was this very puzzling call. And when we finally were able to, it was from my granddaughter, and when we were finally able to translate what she was saying, it was that she had, that at the kindergarten school, at the school and in kindergarten class, there was a girl in her class who had worn an orange Clemson shirt to school.
Yes.
And we said, well, what did you say? She said, I didn't say anything. I just wanted you to know that she was wearing the shirt, that there was this person who was somebody of a different tribe.
Yes, right.
There
exactly.
In her, and she didn't, wasn't able to, she liked this girl, and she was, but she was just taken back that that person would be wearing a Clemson shirt.
It is sort of shocking.
the other side. So how do we deal with this? And we have to do, we have to deal with this every day in Chapel Hill and Durham, because we're a land of this terribly strong, aggressive instincts about each other on the athletic field. And at the same time, we're married to each other. We work with each other. We teach each other and do business with each other every day. How to do it very successfully. On the other hand, when it comes to basketball or our other athletics, we're at each other's.
We can relax into our normal animal.
I mean, how does all that? I mean, you've been thinking about this now for for your whole life, I guess. But how do you explain it? How do you explain that we can be civil and loving and married to, and then when it comes to basketball game days, we can't speak to each other about it. I mean, we can't talk to each other and scream at each other.
Well, I mean, I have to say, without being overly philosophical about it, it really feels so good sometimes to hate so bad. And I guess that's part of it is it's probably even biologically in us, that we have probably appetites and instincts that come from our evolution as hunters. And now we live in this civil society, particularly if you're in North Carolina and where you're supposed to say something nice about people in general. And it could well be that you need to have an outlet for that sort of thing. And sports is a good outlet for it. I mean, in sports, at least, you're not generally killing someone, unless maybe you're Gerald Henderson kind of coming down on Tyler Hansbrough. But I think there's a place for that kind of intensity, and that could be part of it. On the other hand, I mean, I remember Mike Krzyzewski talking about how his daughter was really treated as an outcast when she was in school in Durham. There were so many Carolina fans around, and she would come home crying and upset that she was being treated that way. And then his of course, response was, well, go put on a Duke sweatshirt and go back there and don't crack, because we're Krzyzewski's and we can take it.
Well,
it's pretty amazing laboratory.
Well, there's a clue from Will Blythe about his admiration for the Duke basketball coach, which we'll explore after this short break. Will is the author of To Hate Like This Is to Be Happy Forever. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. My guest is Will Blythe. Will is the author of To Hate Like This Is to Be Happy Forever. And I was pushing you, Will, before the break to explain how we can get along with each other so well with people who went to Duke and Carolina and are, for one reason or another, are fans of either one of those schools. And we hate each other sometimes, and then the other times we can just put it aside. And your title really does say it all, doesn't it? If you can, hating is one way to be happy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just a sad commentary on the human background and human condition.
I'll have to try and publish some sort of auxiliary volume as a self-help book, actually. Hate your way to happiness.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's an open market about whether some people say that we've got to be positive to be successful and happy. Others say, no, you got to balance. You got to work against happiness, too much happiness. And you could just say, no, you guys have got it all wrong. Hate is the answer.
It's like that old commercial where that guy would say, where's the love, man? And my response is, where's the hate, guy?
Well, now that you have become the expert, and part of becoming the expert is that you assert you're the expert, as you did in your book, and then all of a sudden you are, because everybody comes to you and requires you to have an answer for every question they've got about the Duke-Carolina rivalry, and then you go out and you talk to people and you learn all kinds of other things. And
right.
So what, based on the things that you learn writing your book and then what you've learned about yourself and about others in your conversations with other experts afterwards, talk to us about how you looked at this season of Carolina basketball first, where you have the team not as it was when you wrote about it.
Right.
Struggling to be great. Now you have the team which is said by almost everybody to be the contender for the top team in the country. And how's this season been different from the one that you followed when you wrote your book?
Well, I followed the 2005 championship season, but the thing about that team is I think that team...
You followed it, but you're writing with the perspective of what was coming afterwards. I guess that was what...
Right. Yeah. Well, that team, I think, had the sense of being the hunter. This team strikes me, whether they like it or not, as having been, from the start of the season, especially after that amazing start, the hunted.
Mm.
And it seems to me that when I read Roy Williams' responses and press conferences and radio calls and so on, he seems a little on edge this year. He seems, I think, when the guys all decided not to go to the pros and Ty Lawson and Danny Green and Wayne Ellington and Tyler Hansbrough, and they all came back, I think he knew he was going to be dealing with just impossible expectations all year. And as a result, this team, I think, seems to have had to... it's been a great team, and it's only had four losses, and yet people, I think, are always in danger of feeling that it's underperformed. And I think that actually it's been a pretty terrific team. But maybe recently they've had some of that pressure. I don't think that everybody... Obama... that famous basketball handicapper and bracketologist seems to feel that Carolina is going to take it all. But I think a lot of so-called sports experts have taken the mantle away from them, and that may be good.
Well, I got to take a break from our conversation about the comparison between the two seasons and the teams that you observed to say that I thought about talking to you, and again, my thoughts always go back to your dad and to the Mecklenburg County, where he and I both grew up, and the times that he and I were growing up. And the idea, first of all, but people say, well, you know, we could never have imagined an African-American president. Well, that's true, and we've dealt with that one. But your dad and I would not have been able to conceive of having a president of the United States who would take such notice of North Carolina that he would put our team in the center of his bracket as the prospective champion, and would be, you know, that he would really know who we and our team were and identify with us.
Yes.
Now that, I mean, that is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, that
it
North
is.
Carolina has come so far.
It is extraordinary, kind of refreshing in its own way.
Oh man, I mean, it's just for those of us who grew up when we were poor, overlooked, you know, next to Mississippi, the lowest on the totem pole in all the measurement charts, but still very proud of ourselves and our assertion that we were going to be better.
Well, that was one thing about, I think, my father and you and many people, both from Mecklenburg County and other parts of North Carolina, generationally, I think, love North Carolina, perhaps partly in response to the view of it around the rest of the country, but also just in some kind of really native, local way. I mean, that was something that we were brought up with, to love our state. And I do think it's more and more unusual, partly because people move around so much that they don't become affixed to a place.
Yeah.
But, you know, my father was just, you know, in love with the trees of the state, the birds, everything, and that's something that I think is relatively rare these days.
Well, it's for me. Gosh, you get me off on out of basketball, but you talk about the Blythes and the people in Chapel Hill. They know the Blythes through you, your dad, and your mom and brothers and sisters, all of whom have made tremendous contributions here. We know the Berryhill name because of Dean Berryhill. We know the Kathy name because of the great Dean Kathy, and
right,
and many Cowells, all of these great people on the Chapel Hill campus. Well, I know them because their names were colonial. You know, they were the Patriot names.
Right.
And the Blythes have been in Mecklenburg County for hundreds of years, the Cowells and the Berry Hills, the Kathys, all of those names. And so I take you know, and we were poor, know, dirt poor. Yeah. And but y'all were your families were the ones that we looked to as sort of the symbol of long time, good, hearty, Presbyterian, or deeply religious, hardworking people who were going to make us better. And sure enough, they came to Chapel Hill and they did this for us.
Well, that's nice to hear. I mean, then you probably grew up actually also believing in the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, right?
Well, I, like your dad, there are some things that you don't question.
Right.
And you better not in my presence.
That's right. Yeah.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be back to talk more about basketball with Will Blight, the author of To Hate Like This Is To Be Happy Forever, his wonderful treatment of the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill and the Duke basketball rivalry. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. Will Blight, and to those who are listening, I apologize before the break of getting off on too much for me, maybe personal stuff, when there's so much to talk to you about your book and about the Duke and Carolina basketball rivalry. I pushed you, and you're reluctant, I think, maybe to talk about the differences in the team a little bit about the teams. I loved your analogy of the difference between the 85 championship, I mean, the 2005 championship team and the 2009 competitive team, as one being the hunter and the other being the hunted, as far as the Chapel Hill basketball is concerned. And do you now put Duke University basketball on the rise as being the hunter?
Yes.
How does it work?
Well, I mean, because they flamed out so badly in the opening rounds of the NCAAs the last few years, and I think that they have been, for basically a three-point shooting team and a driving team, they got better around mid-season after they made that change and sat Greg Paulus and actually Nolan Smith to an extent, and brought in Elliot Williams and put Shire at the point guard. I think that they're a better team now than they were. I still don't think they're very rugged on the inside, and so you know, I think they kind of necessity have to be a hunter team. But, you know, I think Krzyzewski seems to have recovered a little bit of his recruiting mojo, so it seems like the rivalry's not going anywhere anytime soon.
Will, what's happened to you with respect to your emotional level in dealing with Duke? You got into the heads of the Duke people. You had a wonderful conversation with the guy that you'd thrown shoes at on television,
right,
with Mike Krzyzewski.
Yeah, don't tell anybody that.
And you talked knowledgeably about what's going on with the Duke team, so you're following them. And I accuse you of Stockholm syndrome, that you have been captured by these guys and that you're coming to respect and like them.
Well, you know, I did. I really liked J.J. Redick. I know that he was, that season in particular, pretty much universally despised as the most hated guy in college basketball, which he was well aware of. And yet I found him to be a really immensely likable and intelligent guy who, off the court, was, you know, about as mellow as sunshine. And was a lot of fun to talk to. I mean, he was really interested in history, particularly Civil War history, and he did write poetry. It wasn't the best poetry in the world, but you know, he had good taste in reading and music, and I got to be. There were a lot of other Duke players that I became friendly with. So you know, that was part of the premise or the experiment of the book, was to see what happened when I went among the enemy.
What about this crew of Duke players? Do you feel some a little bit more open to identifying with them when they're not playing Carolina?
Not really.
All right, okay.
You know, I mean, you know,
I don't believe you.
You can only go so far in these kind of life-changing experiments. It's TV, right? I mean, TV is the great distancer. I mean, TV is perfect for lynch mobs. I mean, we've seen it many a time, even over the last election cycle. You can watch TV and feel this great sense of security in venting your most primal and not necessarily very explored prejudices. And so I'm kind of back to where I usually have been, just because it's so much fun to root against the team and to root for a team.
Will, you live in New York. We're hopeful that one day we're going to persuade you to come back where to live where the Blythes belong in North Carolina. But up in New York, you have some distance where you can observe us and our basketball teams with perhaps a little bit more objectivity than we can. And I'm curious, I wrestle with this question all the time. The basketball has become so important, and not just with Carolina and Duke, but also with Wake Forest and North Carolina State and Davidson and the other great basketball programs in some of the smaller colleges. But we live on this and feed on it, and the attention, the national attention that comes to us and to this rivalry, is it a real big positive for North Carolina, or is it just kind of irrelevant? Like, is it like Alabama football, that it doesn't translate into something necessarily that's real positive for the state? We have the feeling, or I have the feeling, that one of the I was going to ask you, but now I'm telling you what my answer is. How do you feel about this?
Well, I mean, I'd be curious to hear what you say. My feeling about it is it has been a great positive, and I think this is true for the state of Alabama, too, Alabama football. But I think primarily in the area of race relations over the last 40 years. I mean, I think that, you know, Charlie Scott, when he came to North Carolina and played in the mid to late 60s, you know, young white kids across the state loved that guy. And, you know, he would go into some places, like he's talked about in Clemson, and had just all sorts of racial epithets hurled at him. But he, I think, you know, he had a whole generation of children that became passionately devoted to him. And I think that, so there was that. And then I think also there was whites and blacks formed common allegiances to these teams. And I think that it really did help integrate the culture. And I've always felt that, you know, basketball was for the middle class, sort of what jazz was once, to sort of the hipster class, which was their way to have immersed themselves in black culture. And I think it, you know, that's why I think that it's no small thing what basketball has brought to the state of North Carolina in all of its accidental ways, you know, the way it got here originally. Who would have dreamed that it might be this conduit or this way of transmitting better race relations? But that's what I think it's done.
Well, there's a whole movement. It's a small movement now, but it's who knows where it will go, that the Civil War monuments of the soldiers who fought so bravely in defense of an unsupportable social system, but we've got these monuments to these people all over our state, that it's time to pull them down because we're not celebrating the bravery of these folks fighting for their homeland, but it's a symbol of an oppressive system. That, well, we pull down Silent Sam and we'll put up a statue of Charlie Scott.
Well, there you go.
There.
Or we can just put up a statue of Charlie Scott. I mean, I just think, you know, and it's appropriate in a way on the day after John Hope Franklin died, or a couple days afterwards, to think about, you know, the way basketball too has helped change race relations. I just think, you know, he was a great scholar of the civil rights movement, and I think you saw the civil rights movement actually take another step after the great victories of the 50s and early to mid 60s with the kind of social integration that, again, I think sports helped bring.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting and maybe a topic for another program, maybe for another wonderful book by you about the many threads that wove a strong cloth that helped us make some progress racially, and one that, again, speaking of your dad, he would have been mighty proud of us for reaching as far as we have. Will, just a second or two, but I wanted to ask you what you're working on now. Are you just celebrating and clipping the coupons and royalty checks from
I wish. Well, I've done a lot of magazine journalism. In fact, oddly enough, with Beyonce, I spent some time with Beyonce and Jessica Simpson, and then I've been writing pieces for the New York Times Book Review, and I'm just mucking around in what I hope will be a new book, but it's fiction, so it's still in the early stages and too fragile to talk about, but that's what I'm doing now.
Well, we can't wait, and we celebrate, and your book, To Hate Like This Is To Be Happy Forever, and we're going to be happy for a long time. Because we got your book at our side. Thank you, Will Blythe.
Well, thank you very much, DG. That's awfully kind of you to say, and I appreciate talking to you.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.